All right, today is March 15th, 2018. These are Academic Staff Award winner interviews that we conduct at the Academic Staff Institute. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program, and we are here at Union South on the campus of UW-Madison. So Dave, to help me out with sound quality, can you say your name and spell your last name?
David Tobin, T-O-B-I-N.
Okay. That looks great. I'm going to get just a touch closer to you, but I think the way you spoke right there will be perfect. So, Dave, I gave you the questions in advance. I'm just going to go through them one by one. As I said, I reserve the right to ask follow-up questions if there's something you say that I feel is appropriate to follow up. So, the first question is, what brought you here to UW-Madison?
Yeah, I got involved with researchers at the Space Science and Engineering Center when I was in grad school at the University of Maryland, because what I was doing in grad school overlapped a lot with what was happening here. I was doing research related to satellite remote sensing, and my thesis advisor, Larrabee Stroh, had already had contacts with people like Hank Rubbercomb and Bill Smith, people that run big research programs here on campus. And so probably when I was like getting my master's degree, I had already started collaborating with this group. And then when I graduated with PhD in 1996, I looked around for jobs, and I had a couple different offers. In fact, I had a job lined up for Los Alamos, and I was ready to go there. And Bill Smith here on campus called me and said, hey, why don't you just come and have a visit and just see how it is out here? I was like, okay, got nothing to lose. Beautiful. I'd never been here. And it was June, and it was a beautiful couple days. Bill took me for a ride on his boat. We went to the Memorial Union, had a great time, and they offered me a postdoc position. And I had just gotten married, and I called my wife, I said, I think we have a change of plans, because this seemed like such a good fit in a number of ways. And that's how I came here. I started I started that fall. I think it was sometime in September. Mm-hmm. Got here in the fall, and it was great.
So when you say that you were involved with the UW-Madison group while you were at, it's Maryland, Baltimore County, right? So this is the mid-90s. You know, you can be involved with people in 2018 a little differently than you can be involved with people due to technology. I'm wondering how were you involved then with UW-Madison while you were still in grad school?
Yeah, I remember, there wasn't cell phones or tweeting or anything like that. I had exchanged emails with a handful of people here, and then we were involved in a field campaign. Both the University of Maryland and the University of Wisconsin was involved in this field campaign in Wallops, Virginia, which is about 3 hours south of Baltimore, which is where I was stationed. And so Wisconsin was down in Wallops Island for 3 or 4 weeks. And I was, I'll drive down there and meet them. And so I met a handful of that group out in the field at Wallops Island. It was the first time I met them. So it's kind of the old-fashioned way of meeting somebody. And it was great. Wisconsin at the time was really had the hardware experience. Basically, they had a copy of the satellite instrument that they would fly on a high-altitude aircraft out of Wallops Air Force Base. Or the NASA Center down at Wallops. It's not an Air Force base. And I spent a handful of days down there talking to them. So, you know, I was very impressed with that. And communications kind of continued over time. I was, my thesis advisor was a team member of a satellite team for NASA. And the guys here at Wisconsin were also on the same team. So after that point, we would go to some of the same meetings at various places like at JPL or at Maryland or all over the place. And so I got to know them that way.
So when you started here as a postdoc, where were you located?
The whole time I've been located, I've been in the Space Science and Engineering Center, which is right at 1225 Dayton Street. And I've moved around on various floors there. But yeah, I've always been in that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So to back up a little bit, sort of what factors led to your work slash research interest?
Yeah. I guess if I back up, you know, as far as I can remember, my dad was an electrical engineer for the Navy. And that took him to Annapolis, where he worked at the David Taylor Naval Research Ship Development Center in just across the river from the Naval Academy in Annapolis. And so I grew up, like, you know, trying to understand what he did, and it was always fascinated me, the engineering and the science of various stuff that he was working on, submarines and aircraft carriers and stuff like that. So I was kind of inclined to go into science and engineering, and that's what I did. I did well in that in school. So when I went to college, I started in a pre-engineering field. I thought I wanted to be a mechanical engineer, but I got involved in, I really enjoyed the physics classes, and I wound up being a physics major. And then I did fairly well, you know, I enjoyed it, and I didn't know what to do. And when I got out, I guess it was 1990 or 1991 when I was graduating with a bachelor's degree, there weren't a whole lot of jobs that I could get that really interested me. And one of the professors, Larrabee Stroh, said, well, hey, why don't you just work for me? You can be a research assistant and get a master's degree. And that's how I got in this field of satellite meteorology and remote sensing, because he was in that field. He had a lab at University of Maryland where we took measurements of radiation, same, you know, to understand the kind of measurements that are needed to remotely sense the Earth, and that's basically how I got into it.
So you've talked a little bit about what you do. I have a history background, so I sort of I've read a little bit about what you do, and I wonder if I'm not alone when I sort of ask you, you know, when someone who doesn't really understand the science asks you what you do, how do you explain that to them?
Yeah, I mean, there's, yeah, I could try. I'm not always the best at it, but there's the what and the how. What we try to do is understand what's happening with the Earth's atmosphere. And both for weather applications and for climate. And one of the most efficient ways to monitor the Earth is from a satellite, because it gives you routine observations of the entire Earth all the time. And so that's the natural way to do it. And so then it comes to, well, what instruments do you put on the satellite, and what orbit does the satellite sit in, and that determines the type of information you get back. So basically we have these cameras that are on satellites that orbit around the Earth all the time, and some of them are just like a normal visible camera that and gives you nice images of the Earth all the time that you see on the evening news and stuff. But the majority of the data we get is in other wavelength regions, like in the infrared. So like would be measuring the temperature of the surface out there, of the field or the road or whatever it is. But then it also measures the temperature of the atmosphere at various heights above the Earth. And so you can use that information to do what's called atmospheric sounding. And all of that is related to the temperature of the air, if there's a cloud there, how humid is it. And so you can reverse all that information and derive, okay, what was the temperature and humidity of the atmosphere when you took that picture? and so then you can feed that into a weather model. This data is the primary data that feeds the weather forecast. You feed that data into a weather model, and then you get forecasts. And if you can do that very accurately, then the weather becomes climate, and you start tracking things. It's basically the same variables, but measured at much higher accuracy. And if you can do this over long periods of time, then you can measure climate. And so it leads to applications of all different kinds. And then there's also various trace gases, ozone, carbon dioxide, methane. And so then that leads into all the kinds of air quality and pollution applications as well.
Okay. Quick follow-up about that. So the way I've heard it when people talk about, you know, climate change or global warming is that weather is the sort of the day-to-day, and there's going to be wide fluctuation in that, which is why it might snow when it's not supposed to, and it might be 60 when it's not supposed to.
Yeah.
But climate is the overall weather tabulated or gathered over a period of time.
That's right.
Is that a fairly, sort of layman's term assessment?
This is a great layman's description of it. And, you know, like one example is, you know, you can have these regional anomalies. Like there's been a couple recently where, for example, the United States has stayed cool over, you know, a couple seasons in a row. And you can say, well, look, we're not warming, and it's a little blip. And then if you look at it on a map of the, you know, the whole world, you see, okay, the rest of the entire world was warmer than us. And yeah, so there's all kinds of up and down natural variability, and climate is kind of the running mean through all of that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that there's probably anything such as a typical day, but sort of what kind of tasks might you do in a typical day?
Yeah. I guess I enjoy it because I don't really have typical days. I'm always doing different things, even when I'm doing research. I mean, I guess that's the nature of research, is it's always different. And it's always a challenge. Sometimes it's really hard and don't make progress, but other times it's, you know, really fun. You do something different. But, you know, my typical day is get up and either ride my bike or take the bus into work, kind of go through the email that I've gotten over the last day and try to get rid of it as quick as possible, but, you know, keep track of the things that really need done. I've got, at any given time, I've got three or four different projects that I'm trying to work on with three or four, you know, different objectives and sources of funding. You know, each one of those has an outline and a schedule associated with it, and as much as possible, I'm trying to keep in the back of my mind where I want to be 2 or 3 years from now and make progress towards it. It's usually driven by, okay, what's the next science team meeting or conference or paper that we're trying to write. And so, yeah, it could be anything related to that. Like, okay, I need to get this this next proposal written, or I need to produce this result for these slides that I want to show at this meeting I'm going to next week. I have about... SACC is an interesting place. It's a very flat organization managerially. We call it a matrix organization. So I've got projects that I'm in charge of that people work for me on, and I keep track of what they're doing, and as well as what I'm trying to get done. But then I am also in an investigators on other people's projects, and so people are asking me to do things, and you know, so it's a circular kind of organization. And then there's, you know, the stuff that's less interesting, like writing reports, turning in your timesheet, tracking your effort. But like a lot of what I do recently has been with the launch of several new satellites, which has been super interesting. We had the last one was launched in late November, and it's the JPSS-1 satellite. It's the second of its kind. It's kind of like a new advanced state-of-the-art satellite, and our group here plays a big role in its calibration, so making sure that it's collecting the right kind of data and verifying that. And so over the last several months, once the instrument was turned on, we've been going through this very kind of methodical series of analyses, looking at the data that comes down, making sure that like it's at the wavelength that we think it is, that the counts and the radiances that it gets are very close to what it should be, and that all the products and processing that comes out of it works correctly. So like we just got done a fairly intense period of doing that. Okay. Yeah.
Is there, so let's say this new satellite isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing, because I'm sure there's an example of that in your career.
There's lots of examples.
How does the team, or how do you and the team fix that?
Yeah, so I mean that's one of the things about a satellite is why they're so expensive is because you have to do a lot of work ahead of time. As much as possible, I mean nothing's guaranteed, but as much as possible to make sure it's going to work the way you think it is once it's up there. Because once it's up there, there's very little you can do. But there are examples of where things have gone wrong. For example, it's not the instrument that I'm associated with, but on the same satellite, there's another instrument where there was a little bit of contamination from water vapor inside the instrument. When the instrument gets up there and gets cold, that water condenses on the coldest thing that's in there and happens to be the lens to a set of the detectors. And so the signal has degraded quite a bit. And so in that instance, what they're doing is that they're taking the instrument offline and heating it up with coolers or with heaters that they have. And they're trying to get that water vapor to dispense and settle somewhere else. That's one example. There's other examples of where like the onboard electrical processing isn't doing what you thought it was, or isn't doing what you wanted it to do. In that case, there's lots of things you can do where you can upload it, depending on the electronics, you can upload a different set of commands and change what the instrument is doing and try to fix it. But there's still going to be artifacts in the data, and so there's lots of things you can do on the ground to either just characterize and tell the users that, okay, this is what you're working with. It's not as good as what we thought it was going to be. And then try to change the algorithms that use that data to be more efficient, still as much as possible produce the products that would, for example, go into a forecast model.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it sounds like the best possible scenario is to try to do all the troubleshooting. I don't know if you probably don't call it troubleshooting, but try to get in a room with smart people and try to figure out what's all the things that could possibly go wrong so we can try to alleviate them before we send the satellite.
Yeah, yeah. And so that happens, you know, that happens a lot. We have these, like I mentioned, these science teams. And like for the one that was just launched, it's a group of probably 50 people among four or five different organizations. And we talk constantly. We have a telecon every Wednesday morning for 2 hours. And people bring up, you know, hey, I'm seeing this. And then we exchange ideas and try to make progress.
Mm-hmm. So I asked a little bit of, in some of the questions I've asked indirectly about technology, you've been doing this now for a couple of decades. I guess if you count your graduate work, you know, more than that.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
So how, in the very broad question, but how has changes in technology changed your work?
Yeah, I guess when I think of that, I think of two things. One is, you know, what do I do on a daily basis? And the other one is, how has technology changed the satellite world? On a daily basis, things change drastically all the time. In particular, the computers. So, like, satellite processing, the processing of satellite data and forecasting has advanced like leaps and bounds, and it's continuing to do so. We had a satellite instrument that was in kind of the concept stage in the late 90s. And at that time, it was thought that, okay, this instrument's going to collect so much data that no one's ever going to be able to use it. And that was one of the biggest challenges of the instrument. Well, that instrument actually didn't fly. It didn't happen until probably 10 years later. 10 years later, you could take all the data from that instrument and process it on your laptop. You needed a nice, good laptop, but you know, you didn't need a supercomputer or something to do that. And so, yeah, and the data analysis and the forecasting. Forecasting is constantly getting smaller and smaller grid cells spatially and finer time steps. And that is one of the fields that really pushes the computer processing. SACC currently has the largest computer on campus. It's a supercomputer with cluster nodes, but it's there in order to run a forecast model. It's one of the most demanding things. And so it's not my expertise, but that's why, for example, we have one of the biggest technical computing groups on campus, and we house our own data center. It's one of the largest data centers in the Midwest. And then on the satellite side, it's the technology that's available keeps advancing. Like the cameras and technology and the optics keeps advancing at a very high rate. So what's capable of doing is, what we can do now if we built a new instrument right now would be leaps and bounds beyond what you could do even 10 years ago. The thing that's interesting is we're dealing with NASA and NOAA, these big government institutions, which don't like to change things that quickly. And so, for example, this instrument that I described, the one that was launched most recently, that design actually goes back to about 1998. And it's because the requirements process and the users and the government, just things related to the government, are so slow. In fact, right now we're trying to change the requirements and the design of the next version of that instrument. And it's one of the more frustrating things to see. Other countries have completely different approaches. For example, right now China has an approach where they are learning how to do this and advancing by doing it. And so, for example, they have a paradigm where every 2 years they're going to launch a new instrument, a new satellite with a set of new sensors on it, whether they're ready or not. And at any given time, they're going to put on their best technology. And it's a completely different way of doing things, but it's allowing them currently to make great advances in this field.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. So about halfway through here, we'll see what we get through the rest of the time. So we're now going to shift to talking about you as an academic staff person. So the first question is a sort of a yes, no, and we'll see where it goes from there. So were you involved or have you been involved in academic staff governors or groups?
Yes.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about which ones you've been involved
in? Yeah. I was a member of the Academic Staff Assembly representing my district for I think it was 3 years, maybe 8 or 10 years ago. And I basically did it because I was interested in knowing what happened and, you know, trying to make sure that our district was represented.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, more very recently, I've been a member of what's, I don't know if I can get the name right, but it's called the Ad Hoc Committee on Research and Scientist Titles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I got involved in that because I think it's important. Number one, there's a lot of very good research that's done on this campus by academic staff, and it's not necessarily appreciated at the highest levels. And also, important thing coming down the road is this idea of a research professor. So it's a kind of perhaps a new title that the academic staff people will be allowed to have.
Okay. So I think you've sort of answered this, but I want to ask it directly. So when you've been involved in these two things, this is a two-part question. So, you know, what do you think you offered, and then what do you think you gained?
That's a good question. You know, what I saw, especially with the academic staff, let me answer it separately. With the Academic Staff Assembly, what I saw was that there was, I guess understandably, was a big kind of slow-moving governance group. And not a lot happened. I'm not sure that I really offered a whole lot, to be honest. What I saw, and I kind of knew this, well, at the Space Science and Engineering Center, it's almost entirely academic staff, and it's kind of on the edge of campus. And that's the only world I really cared about. And there was no even concern that academic staff weren't represented well. In our center there, you know, if you have a proposal or an idea or whatever, you could be PI, you write the proposal, you get it funded, and you move on. was relatively little interaction with faculty or even other groups. And so being part of the academic staff assembly, I saw, you know, that we were actually kind of unique in that sense, whereas more kind of traditional academic units, the academic staff, of course, play, you know, you can have researchers, but you can have all different kinds of other academic staff roles. And in particular, that the academic staff, depending on what unit you're in, didn't have a lot of say in what happens. Not sure I was more of an observer in that role. In this most recent committee, I feel like we've done a lot of good work. What I learned there, I heard a lot more about the restrictions that academic staff have placed on them in other units, because they are simply because they're academic staff and not able to do the research that they want or write the proposals that they want because of that. People from all over the campus in different units. I do feel like we have offered a lot. I feel like this research professor's title series, which, except for one, all of our other peer universities have. I feel like that could really be a positive thing for academic staff research on campus and would really promote and allow the campus to do a lot more research with relatively little investment.
So we talked. I think you've started to allude to this in your answer, but I want to ask directly because it's one of the questions I like to ask academic staff award winners. Do you think about the relationship between faculty and staff? And if so, you know, what are your thoughts?
Yeah. So, like I said, I really hadn't thought about it much till the last couple years, because. SACC was kind of isolated and I would say kind of unique in the sense that it's almost entirely academic staff. And for example, I think it has currently 43 principal investigators and all of them are academic staff. There's a handful of AOS department faculty members that will run their grants through SACC. But there wasn't a whole lot of I even thought that I gave to it. But like I said, through these other governance things that I've been involved more recently, definitely there's a difference between faculty and academic staff attitudes and perception. I look at it from the research side, you know, the research papers and the research that academic staff do and the proposals they write are no different than what a faculty member might do.
Okay. Thank you. So now I want to ask about a specific point in time, because you were on campus during a moment that not only affected, you know, campus, but affected the country and the world.
Yeah.
And that's 9/11, 2011. 2001, excuse me. So I wonder if you could talk about, and you can either talk about it personally, professionally, or both,
yeah.
Your memories of that day and the sort of the immediate aftermath.
Sure, yeah. I remember it very clearly. I was getting ready for work. I was at home, and I walked out of my bedroom area into, like, the living room, and the TV was on, and I looked at looked at it. It was like there's an airplane running into the World Trade Center building. I was like, is that a joke? And I just couldn't believe it. And, you know, I was kind of in shock. Like, and then, so I believe that was a Thursday or a Friday. I can't remember. But the following week, we were holding a big workshop here at UW-Madison, where there were about 30 people coming from all over the country and even outside of the country that would be flying in over the weekend. And I got to work, and I was sitting there talking with Hank Rivercombe, who's my mentor, and he was also, both of us were running this workshop. And it took us like an hour or so to realize that, hey, there's no way that people are going to be flying it around the country or over the weekend. And then it kind of settled in. It like, you know, it hit us that, oh my gosh, what really happened?
Do you remember some of the immediate aftermath here on campus?
You know, I don't. You know, I know it was horrific, but I kind of don't remember any specifics.
So how did the did you end up pulling the workshop later?
Yeah, we canceled the work. We sent out an email, said, you know, this is canceled. We wound up holding it several months later.
Okay. So now I want to, the final question before we get to a legacy question is the story behind the Academic Staff Award. So the first question is, you know, when did you find out or did you know you were nominated?
Yeah, I did know I was nominated. I was nominated by my mentor, I guess you would say it, and the previous director of the center, Hank Rivercombe, and by the current director, Steve Ackerman. And I think they just walked into my office and told me that, hey, we've nominated you for this.
So do you recall, I mean, it wasn't that long ago, do you recall your thoughts or reactions when you found out that not only had you been nominated, but you actually won?
Yeah, I was blown away. Because I know how much research goes on this campus and how many very good academic staff researchers there are. I consider myself to be fairly young in my career. And yeah, I was just blown away and humbled.
Was there a reception?
There was. There was a reception at the Pyle Center on one evening. It was very enjoyable. There was all the award winners there and the chancellor. And I had my wife and my son there. And Hank and Steve. And I thought it was very enjoyable. It was great. It was really interesting to hear the chancellor's remarks and then also hear what all of the other award winners did. Mm-hmm. Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
Place. You know, it's the appreciation for all the different things that happen on the campus. You know, I'm probably aware of 5% of it.
Mm-hmm. One more thing before I get to these this final question. It's something that dawned on me earlier, and then you just mentioned the fact, you know, you have a wife and a kid. So I'm wondering how
I have two kids.
Oh,
I have
kids.
A daughter that's in college. Oh, okay. She was unable to attend,
okay.
But yeah, sorry.
So work life balance. So,
oh, yeah.
So my example, you know, I have I'm an academic staff. I have a job. We're open. The archives is open 9 to 5, and I try to work as hard as I can from 9 to 5. But then from 5 to 9, I sort of consider that with some exceptions to be, you know, my time.
Yeah.
So I wonder how you have handled or tried to handle, you know, having a job but also having a life outside of your
yeah.
job.
Yeah, I mean, that's tough. I think it's tough for anybody, not just, you know, me. As much as possible, I try to keep that time for, especially when my kids are young, to, you know, keep work as much as possible at work and not bring it home too much. But that certainly doesn't happen all the time. Mm-hmm. Basically, you know, there's a lot of travel. There's a lot of meetings and field experiments, and you know, which is great. You know, I've been all over the world with this job. But I've also missed a lot of stuff. And there's a lot of... It goes in phases. There'll be times when, you know, I'll have a seemingly normal schedule. But then there'll be times like with this satellite commissioning where, yeah, I'll be at work till much later than I like. Or I'll come home and try to do have dinner and see everybody and then be up till all hours of the night trying to cram things in. But, you know, I love it. It's fun.
Right. And that might be one of the effects of technology, is that, you know, when you started in the 90s, late 90s, you weren't necessarily able to bring work home, or maybe a different way, but we're completely connected wherever we are now.
Yeah.
That's more of a comment than anything else.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was very reluctant to get a cell phone. I was probably one of the last ones to get one. But yeah, now we're constantly in touch.
Mm-hmm. So my final questions before I then ask you if you have anything you want to add is sort of the idea of legacy. I know, you know, you feel, I'm assuming, sort of mid-career, but you have been here 20 years. So I wonder if you at this point have thought anything about what you might be remembered for, and then sort of the follow-up, that sort of the aside to that is, do you think it's the same thing that you will be remembered for?
Yeah, that's a good one. I don't know. You know, I hope people remember me as, I mean, it probably sounds silly, but I hope people remember me as a nice, considerate person. You know, the work stuff is, and all, you know, is good and all. It's interesting, but what it comes down to is how you treat people. And so, yeah.
So I want to make sure that if there's something on your mind about your time here, you know, whether it's your work here, the academic staff work, that we make sure that you sort of get the last word. So is there anything else that you want to make sure?
Yeah, I thought about that. I can't think of anything.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost at 45 minutes. So, Dave, thank you very much. This concludes the Oral History with Dave Tobin.